football on Off the Ball.
Brian Mbeumo is a fantastic character as well as a fantastic footballer. And that's what Manchester United need. You know, you know what United have been missing. They've been missing leaders, responsibility takers.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Offtheball.com/join. Now, I'm delighted to say Eamon Coughlan is with us. It's an annual event at this point, Eamon.
It certainly is.
We're here to talk about the Griffith Avenue Mile and everything else that's going on in the world of athletics. But the Griffith Avenue Mile is one of those community events organised by volunteers that stops traffic on Griffith Avenue. And I don't know, I've just been overwhelmed by how brilliant the day is and what an occasion it is. And you've been involved from the start, helping to promote it.
Very much so, and I'm happy to help Merino Athletic Club and all the people up there at All Hallows on Griffith Avenue area, because the Griffith Avenue Mile, which originally was called the Dublin Mile, took place in 1983, almost 32 years ago almost, and or 42 years ago.
Yeah, God, we lost a decade there. It's all right. It happens on the show
sure.
all the time.
When ABC Wide World of Sports came to Dublin to film the race live in US television, and we had Sidney Marie and myself and Ray Flynn and some of the great milers from around the world came here. And then it didn't take place thereafter until about 5 years ago, when the committee up in Merino Athletic Club decided, hey, let's rejuvenate this, let's renew this, but we'll make it more of a community event. And it's open to anybody who wants to participate. It's only 1 mile on the most beautiful tree-lined avenue perhaps in North County Dublin. I better not say South County Dublin.
Everywhere in Dublin.
But yeah, it's really fantastic. A fast mile race, relatively flat and then downhill towards the end. So it's great that those people have come together to put this community event on. It's for mums and dads, it's for good athletes, it's for middle athletes, it's for people who are aspiring to be athletes, to be able to go up there and test themselves over 1 mile and see what time they can get for that distance.
So it's taking place on Sunday, September the 21st. Yeah. You can get tickets at griffithavenuemile.ie. What loads of the local GAA clubs and rugby clubs and soccer clubs do is they get their teams to do it as a group, and everybody comes and they wear their jerseys and it, and then afterwards there is a festival. Yeah. Afterwards
with,
in All Hallows with music and food and stuff as well. So it kind of feels like it's part of the zeitgeist of athletics at the moment, Eamon, where it's had a bit of a rebirth in the last decade and a half. I don't know how you feel about that, given that you were part of the, like, a wave of us being really, really good at it. And we haven't quite reached the same heady heights just yet as your era, but we're getting much closer now than we have been really since Sonia's era.
There's no question about it. I'm really excited with the state of Irish athletics at the moment. All our athletes competing at the highest level, at world level. And when you consider the World Championships, which start next Saturday week in Tokyo, if you look at the men's, we've got representatives in the 800, the 1500, the 5,000 metres, the 10,000 metres, the marathon, the walk, just to name a few. And then if you look at the ladies' events, you know, we have Sarah Healy and Sophie O'Sullivan in the 1500 metres. We have Katie O'Connor in the heptathlon, which is an incredible event, and she'll probably be our best prospect at a medal in that particular discipline over there. And it's really good to see the range of disciplines that are represented at world-class level by Irish athletes today.
Before we get to who's not there, I do want to ask you about some of the other trends that are happening at the moment. We're seeing athletes stay at home and have great careers. We're seeing athletes go to England and have great careers, and we're also still seeing some athletes choosing to go to America. I guess maybe traditionally there was a cookie cutter, go to America if you can, because that's where you're going to get the best coaching and the best exposure. Would you be less dogmatic about that now if somebody came to you asking for advice, or would you still feel like if you get the opportunity to go and pit yourself against the best collegiate athletes in the States, that's the thing to do?
Yeah. I'd have to be honest and say I'd be biased towards America from my experience all those years ago, and now I go back to America quite regularly and I do be around the college scene. I just think America provides you with a proper environment. You've obviously got the coaching, you've obviously got the facilities, but you're also thinking at a different level. You're seeing these other athletes who are really much better than you, and when you come to live with them, train with them, all of a sudden you begin to believe, hey, they're just as ordinary as I can beat these people. So if you learn to beat your teammates in the college that you're representing, all of a sudden that's going to elevate you to a different plateau altogether. However, having said that, you know, it's some athletes it doesn't suit. to go to America, between homesickness and loneliness or whatever it might be over there, the college education and athletics programs available to them now is an awful lot better than it was 40, 30, 20, even 10 years ago. And I think even some of the American athletes who are potentially going into college are now, because of the professionalism in it and the NIL, they're opting not to compete in the American system, which people kind of regard as it's one that really runs you down. You know, you're competing really hard week after week after week, you're doubling up, tripling up, and it just burns you out altogether. But I think...
That's the bit, isn't it? That's the only real downside, is that obviously you are singing for your supper as a scholarship student. You have to show up when they tell you to, and maybe you get a bit burnt out and it takes a while to recover from that.
Well, you got to really train hard to race hard, and you got to work hard in order to get to the highest level. And if you're not prepared to do that, you're not going to survive. So if you really train hard, whether it's in Ireland or in the UK or in Europe somewhere, you're still going to get burned out. But I think it's the overall system around the college career. It certainly provides with better opportunities. But at the same time, as I said, it just comes down to that individual. Does America suit him or her? Does Ireland suit him or her? And that's up to the athlete to decide themselves. And once that decision is made, you can't, you've got to say the grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah.
So you've got to be really careful. But I still favour the American system. And if you look at the Irish athletes, Sonia O'Sullivan, Ray Flynn, Frank O'Mara, Marcus O'Sullivan, just to name a few who've gone through the American system, they would say still to this day that the American system is an awful lot better for that athlete coming out of junior age group, like 18, 19, 20, 21, and it provides them with a better transition in America, because you're working in that area throughout it.
What should we do around that, Eamon, do you think? Because, like, it just as you describe it, it makes an awful lot of sense to me, as in, you know, the competitive aspect to it. We can't replicate here, no matter how much we were to invest in facilities. But either side of that, what do we need to be doing here to, you know, can, you know, post-college kids should be coming back, or the lead into that? What do we need to do to, yeah, get better at facilitating our best athletes at home?
Well, I think we're getting better as it is. Having mentioned all the athletes that are competing in the World Championships, we've a record number of athletes going to Tokyo for the World Championships. So things have gone better. What percentage of those athletes that are going to the World Championships have gone to America? I'm not even sure. I haven't looked at the stats, but it's probably 50-50. And in terms of Ireland, there's an awful lot more funding has gone into sports over the last 10, 15, 20 years. It's really, really been professionalised. The athletes have to reach certain standard before they get the facility, before they get the funding. The tracks have improved around the country. The whole backup support system, from medical support to coaching support, has certainly improved in the last number of years. And I think the evidence of that is the number of those competing. How do we make it better? We've just got to find the talent. Talent ID is very important, I think, there. And when you see kids coming through at 13, 14, 15, all you have to do is have a look at them and you can see. And then once you talk to them and get to know their temperament, that's when you say, okay, we've got to step up here now. And I think that's where the backup support is needed. However, having said that, if you take the likes of Sarah Healy, Sarah remained, Mark English, medical doctor, Sarah Healy, you know, Kieran McGeehan, they've all stayed in Ireland. And then they've gone over to the UK, where they're working with a really good group. And if you're in Ireland, the tendency is that you don't have that group around you, supporting you, helping you, pushing you on the track. That's why they have gone over to England and they've replicated America without the college aspect of it.
The talent ID bit is hard, isn't it? Because, you know, the pervasiveness of GAA, rugby, soccer, all those sort of traditionally, inverted commas, sort of bigger sports. It's hard, but it's crucial to try and at some point get the message to the kids who could be the next generation of the...
Well, I think it's a matter of really focusing on the talent ID. And once you have identified them, it's to really work with them. Maybe that's not happening enough over here. So identify someone at 14 years of age, 13 years of age, really to work with them. But the problem there is you have coaches in the clubs who, these are my athletes and I'm not going to let them go into a national coach or whatever it may. So I think that needs to be addressed, and to create a really good, strong academy and instill confidence and instill belief in those young athletes coming through. And once they start believing that, all of a sudden they will improve gradually.
What do you think is happening with Rashida? Because obviously Sonia wrote an article in the Irish Times that there was a bit of controversy around, where she was kind of hinting at stuff without actually saying anything. And then Coach Flo responded to a question from Carl Denny. Sorry, yeah. I was saying, look, she's injured, you know. So is it possible that she's a bit burnt out after finishing fourth in the Olympic Games and hasn't quite recovered from that?
Well, I'd actually say she'd be probably more motivated after finishing fourth in the Olympics to come back this year and try and get on the rostrum in the World Championships. I take it at face value, to be quite honest with you. I've been down that road myself, and I believe she's had niggling injuries. She may have tried a few different things differently in training to improve the stamina over that last 50 metres into 400 metres. So when an athlete is looking for 1% or 2% improvement, they will do different things. They might go on a diet, and all of a sudden, the diet is wrong. You're losing weight and you're losing your strength. Then you might start doing bounding exercises, weightlifting exercises, hill bounding exercises, something that they may not have done before. Now, I'm not saying Rashida and our coach have gone down this road, but I do know she started doing more distance running over 600 metres in races to try. Did that work for her or not? I don't know. But I take it at face value that she's injured. I know back in 1984 Olympic Games, having won the World Championships, I was injured for 3-4 months in advance with 2 stress fractures, but I didn't tell anybody because mystery was power to me. I knew if I told nobody, I'd try and overcome my injuries, I might come back. Whereas if I told people what was going on with me, it would be harder for me to come back, or the other athletes might know, oh great, he's injured, you know, we'd be able to have one up on him. So they like to just keep things quiet themselves. And I think maybe Sonia was delving into something there and didn't really get it right and wrote about it. And of all the people to write something like that, Sonia O'Sullivan kind of surprised me. Because if you look back to the 1996 Olympic Games, Sonia had a pretty bad time in the Olympic Games. Why? Because she wasn't right. She wasn't training well. She'd go to the track and do a workout in the afternoon. It wouldn't go well. And then in the evening, she'd go back again and she'd try and do the same workout. And said, like, hold on a second. You've got to back off. Sonia wasn't really eating well. She was working on her diet to try and improve. So Sonia kept that to herself and didn't tell anybody. That was her business. So I'm surprised that Sonia was looking through and trying to identify, well, what's the real deal here with Rashida? In my opinion, she's injured. Leave it alone and move on and get ready for next year.
So from your perspective, keeping that bit of mystery was a psychological boost. And whether or not it's true, right? You felt it was true, which is kind of all that mattered at the time?
Absolutely. Yeah.
In retrospect, would you do anything differently now, knowing everything you know? If you could tap yourself on the shoulder and go back, tell everybody you're injured, you know, get, I don't know. Or no, is it like...
Okay.
There's a power and a mystique in being showing up and... At the start line, sometimes you can win and lose races. Is that part of that?
You want to show up right. But I think from my experiences, I didn't manage my injury problems correctly at the time. Right. And when a doctor would say, and I didn't have the medical backup support back then like the athletes do today. And when you're injured and you're told to take off for 2 or 3 weeks, it's very hard during those 2 or 3 weeks. And after maybe 10 or 12 days, the leg might feel better, the hamstring might feel better, the knee might feel better. So what do? You go out and you test it. You go train again. And all of a sudden, the niggles are just as bad as they were. And then you rest it for another maybe 3 or 4 weeks. So now 8 weeks has gone by and you're not really in shape. And then you come back again and you try again and all of a sudden the niggle is there. So they linger on and on and on. Because you keep hoping that things will get better. And then when you realise you don't have the fitness, you don't have the strength, you don't have the speed, you don't have the confidence, you've just got to say, that's it, I'm giving up. So why should Rashida all of a sudden divulge to the media and in this day of social media tell everybody what her problems are outside of her injuries? She may not have any problems other than she's completely distraught and upset that she's not going to go and battle for a medal in the World Championships.
And the other thing is that if you come out and you say you have something, then that becomes the story about you every time you hit the start line and everybody asks you about it again and again and again. And so it becomes this perpetual narrative. Whereas now it's going to be, she's off for a while. If she comes back next year and gets back to the form she was at, everybody will be like, well, that really worked for you.
And they forget about it.
What was it? Oh, well, look, I was injured.
I was injured.
And you move on.
Yeah.
There's some sort of sense that she owes something to people here. And by the way, I totally agree with you, just to get my cards on the table. I think she's absolutely entitled to say, I've something going on and I'm not going to be there, and that she's taken at face value for that. But the arguments I've heard are some sort of an owing to fans here, given her profile.
I don't know whether she owes anybody anything at all. She's done a great service to athletics over the last number of years. And you've got to remember, she hasn't won anything yet, by the way. She's been built up into be the superstar that she is and potentially will be even bigger in the future. But that'll only be based on winning, 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 winning. She hasn't won anything yet. At all. So the pressure is on her. Now, in terms of putting her, people who are saying maybe she's doing a disservice to athletics and a disservice to the team at the World Championships coming up, I would disagree with that because they don't really know what's going on. That's just their opinion. And I've got my opinion. My opinion is those who are saying she's doing a disservice by not running in the relay under their present fitness level is one thing, but she realises she's not good enough at the moment. She's not fit enough at the moment. And it's better off letting somebody else compete on the team, and that somebody else could be 2 seconds slower than her. But they're saying, well, if she does 2 seconds, will make a big difference when it comes to the anchor leg and the relay if Rashid is in there. But she's saying, I'm injured, I'm tired, I'm weary, I won't be able to compete at my very best. Why would you blame her for that?
Well, the same people will be saying, if she goes in injured and takes somebody else's place and is only half fit when she gets there, the same people will be saying, you should have stood aside and let somebody else have a go.
Like, she wants to compete at her very best. And if there's a niggling injury there, by continuing to train, even half train over the last 2 weeks leading up to next week, 3 or 4 weeks in between when she announced that she wasn't going to do it, that injury's not going to get any better.
No.
So you have to be selfish, really selfish, and decide, as hard as the decision is, I can't compete. She has to stick to her guns to get herself physically right again and to rebuild in the winter months and come out next year.
Sonia was very specific. She was saying, if you look at the comments, people are acting like it's the end of the world or telling Adelecki how great she is and she'll bounce back stronger. Sorry, but that's not always what the athlete needs to hear in these difficult situations. A bit more realism is required. Maybe at 21, 22, Rashida is inexperienced and somebody in her camp does need to say, well, this is the truth of the situation. But telling a young woman that she doesn't understand her own body, it seems weird to me. It seems like an odd position for Sonia to have taken in this circumstance.
I just don't understand it, why Sonia would come out with that line. And I'm good mates with Sonia. I was with her last week over in Zurich and we didn't even talk about it at all because I knew she was probably upset by the negative feedback that she got as a result of the comments that she made in the paper. I just take it at face value. She's injured, leave her alone and let's get on with it. Don't be delving into something that you really don't know what's going on and speculate what it might be.
I wonder, is part of the backlash against all of this to do with the relay team and how invested we've become in the relay team because they were so successful? The mixed relay has been such a brilliant invention in modern athletics. Everybody tunes in and watches it. You see some of the best athletes in the world and how devastated they are in a team environment, which we never see. And Rashida, even not running at her very best, would still make at least the women's team, and more than likely she'd be running the last leg in the mixed team if she showed up and didn't run it. So maybe there's like you're denying us this opportunity, but like, if she's not fit, she's not fit.
Well, she didn't do a Roy Keane job here now. You know, like in Saipan, she didn't do that. Where everybody was really disappointed. He wasn't injured. He wasn't injured. He just was upset. He had a tiff with Mick McCarthy. Absolutely. And the facilities down there. Did Roy let Ireland down? He probably did, big time. Is Rashida letting Ireland down because she's injured, genuinely injured? No, she's not. She just had to face up to the facts. I'm injured. I can't go on anymore. I need to get out of here. I don't think she's letting anybody down at all. It's disappointing, for sure. She'd love to be there more than anybody else would like to be there.
But LA is the big thing, right? Like that has to be everybody's focus and getting right for LA and arriving there with the experience and the knowledge and the self-confidence and the form is really what matters over the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, you know, they say the Olympic Games is your final day of judgment, right? And from my experience, and I don't want to be talking about myself, but I finished fourth in the Olympic Games in 1976 and I was devastated. But I was mad keen to make sure I got it right for 1980. I won nearly everything in between 1976 and 1980. And then I get sick as a dog and I had also a stress fracture in 1980. And I went to the Olympics injured, but I didn't tell anybody that I was injured. But I tried and tried, lucky to qualify for the final, and I ended up finishing fourth. Again, I wasn't as devastated as I was the previous time. So again, 4 more years, I'll try again. Get ready for the LA Olympic Games over 5,000 metres. Came back really strong, won the World Championships. And what happens leading up to the Olympics in 84? I get injured again. And when I got injured, I told nobody. I was coming back too soon, like I said earlier, and it just wasn't going away. So I came home to run in the national championships in the 5,000 metres, and I was running against my great mate, John Tracy. John was training for the marathon. And after about five laps in that 5,000 metre race, six laps, I knew I can't go on, the pain in my shin. So after seven or eight laps, John was pulling away from me at ease, and I said, that's it, I can't go on. And I pulled out of the race, put on my tracksuit, got my gear together, jumped into the car, told nobody, I'm out of here. And as I'm driving down out of Santry Stadium, Morton Stadium, at the intersection there at Santry Avenue, I saw this man crossing in a, on crutches with one leg. And I said to Yvonne, and I'm only worried about missing the Olympic Games. Look at that poor man over there. The next day, I get a phone call from the great Noel Carroll. Eamon, don't be making a hasty decision, because I said I'm not running the Games, that's it. But don't give any reasons why, other than I have a stress fracture. Don't make any hasty decisions. You have another few weeks. You can get ready. I said, Noel, I'm out of here. I can't do this at all. Good luck.
It's mad, the intensity of the feelings. Like, and if you were playing in a team sport, and it's an obvious thing to say, but you could camouflage that. You could be a bit of a decoy for somebody else. You could just show up and coast along. But in your sport, if you're not right, you're not right. Did you ever recover from that?
Recover from?
The psychological pain of not being able to represent yourself properly at the Olympics.
Oh, absolutely. Of course you have to recover from that. You move on. You know,
I suppose you say that, right?
Yeah.
But how did you do that?
That's what I'm saying. 4 year cycles. You plan for the next one. But in LA, I was old now. I'm reaching what, 31, 32 years of age almost, and at the time. But again, like I say, it's the Olympic cycle. Your final day of judgment. An athlete wants to focus on that. Wants to win. Wants to get a medal in the Olympic Games. So that's what keeps you motivated. So was I motivated after again pulling out of Los Angeles Olympic Games? I sure was. I wanted to go to Seoul, but the problem was I was running out of time. I was getting older. I was going to be 36 when it came to Seoul. However, I was motivated to train hard. And during that period, my body kept breaking down. I wasn't really hitting the targets. Yet I was winning some indoor races and some outdoor races. But you have to be finely tuned, physically and mentally, well prepared in order to compete at the highest level. And the Olympic Games does crazy things to your head. It just makes you do just different things. All sorts of pressures enter your mind. You try all kind of different things instead of just stepping back, chilling out, like I would advise myself all these years later. What would I have done? I would have stepped back. I would have rested. I would have been looked at. Could have got looked after, and just get myself mentally fresh and physically fresh again.
In retrospect, which of the three Olympics that you've talked about there was actually your best chance?
My best chance was 76 and 80.
Right.
76, I was fresh, I was well, but I was a young 21-year-old kid, like Rashida was, competing in the Olympics last year, a little bit raw. And I just made a stupid tactical mistake by going into the lead after 400 metres, and I was the sacrificial rabbit in the lead, and they're all sitting on my ass behind me, you know? And I kept trying and trying and trying, instead of doing my normal race. That's why I say the Olympics do funny things to you. Mm. Instead of doing my normal race, sit, kick, and I could kick from anywhere, but this time I was rabbit, 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 and they were fresh behind me. 1980 Olympic Games, I probably could have won it. I definitely could have got a medal, and because I was winning and I was in really good shape, but all of a sudden then I had a pain in my shin bone. It was awful. And then I went to the Olympics and I got sick when I was in the Olympics. So between the pain in my shin and between the diarrhea and the vomiting, I had no strength in my body at all.
Was that food poisoning or... was it nerves
I remember I stayed at home in Ireland until about maybe 3 days before my first round of the Olympics then.
There in Moscow?
In Moscow, yeah. But there were reports coming back from people suffering from dysentery.
Right.
And there was problems with the water. Would you believe, I got a 5-gallon drum of water from Ireland, brought on the plane to Moscow with me. I get off the plane, I'm going through customs, and these guys are looking at my big canister of water. They're opening it up and they're smelling it, and they're deciding, will we let this guy take it or not? And eventually they let me take the water. So I brought my own drinking water from Ireland to Moscow with me. But the thing was, I got sick. A vomit and diarrhea. And I went to Dr. Maura O'Brien, who was the Olympic doctor at the time in Moscow. And I said, gosh, she said to me, oh, you've either got, you know, a flu bug or you've got an infection. Here's a tablet. That'll plug it for you, right? But it wasn't. I was completely depleted of all energies.
Yeah.
I was drained and no strength at all. And as I say, while I was disappointed finishing fourth, it was actually a miracle that I even made it into the final then.
So you've less regret about 80 than you have about 76, where it's the tactical mistakes, even though your fitness is
out. Absolutely. Yeah. And then 1984, again, I was injured, unfortunately, again. Again, because looking for that 1% improvement, you start training harder, harder, harder. You start watching your diet. You do all sorts of stupid things. Instead of just being normal and forget about it. Jumbo Elliott was a great philosopher in terms of, he used to say, goddamn Irishman. When he was nervous and he wanted to make a point, he'd stutter. Goddamn Irishman. I want you to run like a horse, he'd say. And I go, what do you mean I want you to run? You just do the running and let me do the thinking. In other words,
he's the jockey.
If you think too much, it'll affect your performance.
And is that true? Like, because it sounds like tactically, as your career went on, though, you would have become tactically far more adept. So you were probably capable of thinking your way through your race, going, this pace is too much, I'm going to ease back. This pace isn't enough, I'm going to actually pick it up a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're really on your game, you're 100% fit, you're mentally fresh, you're physically fresh, you're on top of your game. You've run against these guys before, you've beaten all these guys before, so you know going into a race, your confidence is there. But you still get nervous and your head gets in the way. But when things are really not going well, your head gets in the way more and more and more. You keep digging a hole for yourself to try and get out of that situation, and it just gets worse and worse. And I think that's probably what was happening to Rashida. Things weren't going well. She was digging a hole deeper to look for perfection. It wasn't coming. She'd dig it more. And that just wears you out. Mm-hmm. And you just want to get away from it. So Rashida, she wants to be there more than anybody else. She decided, that's it, I've had enough, I just got to get out of here. And I don't want to talk to anybody about it.
Yeah.
I want to just leave it alone.
Was there sports psychologists when you were competing?
No, there weren't, would you believe.
Even in the States?
No, there weren't. No, there weren't. But I used to get probably two or three times a year over the years letters with questionnaires from people who were studying sports psychology and asked to fill them out. And like, that's me. Hey, I'm okay. I was very fortunate that my coach, Jerry Farnan, and Jumbo Elliott were really great. I believed in everything they told me. And an example of that was, let me do the thinking, you do the running. So when it came to training, I focused on it. When I finished my workout, I'd forget about it, I'd go off, I'd chill out, either with my college mates or when I was married with Yvonne at home and the kids, and I didn't even think about running. Running, I just forgot about. So when you're now getting caught up in preparation for the Olympic Games, the year before, the 6 months, your head does terrible things to you, and you just lose the focus if you're not on top of your game, and if you don't have the belief, I can beat these anyhow. Mm.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It becomes self-perpetuating, the negativity, and all of a sudden...
Absolutely.
So hopefully the break...
It's like standing over a ball in golf. Your head gets in the way.
As soon as you start thinking that this thing has to go over there, and if
I hope
it doesn't...
I don't put this out of bounds, or I hope I don't just put it into the water. And what do? You put it into the water. I hope I don't shank this. And what do? You shank the ball.
So it was 85 when you retired then, was it? 85, 86?
So I really retired after 1988 Olympic Games, when I went to the game again. I wanted to go to the Olympics, and I was older and so forth. I got through the heats into the semi-final, and the semi-final, I was just worn out. I was too old, and I finished, I think, second last in the semi-final. And it was the following year I called it quits. I ran the Millrose Games, the Wanamaker Mile, and Marcus O'Sullivan kicked my ass in it. And I knew if I'm finishing third or fourth or fifth in the Wanamaker Mile in Madison Square Garden that I shouldn't be here anymore. So I retired. And then in 1992 or so, 93, I got the idea of becoming the first person over 40 to run first ever sub 4 minute mile at that age. Roger Bannister had done it in 1954, and John Walker was talking about doing it. David Moorcroft, the great British runner, was talking, and Thomas Vessinghag. All my peers were looking at doing it. So I decided, you know what? I'm fresh now. I haven't run for the last year and a half, really. Maybe I'll build myself up. So I trained for the New York City Marathon to get the miles into my legs again. And on easy training, I ran 2:25 for the marathon. That was my foundation. So I came back to try and run the first 4 minute mile. That first year, I ran 4:01.3, broke the world record 12 or 13 times, but didn't get the sub four. The following year, I'm injured again. And I go, now I'm 41 years of age, and I get down to Gerard Hartman, who was working out of Florida at the time. He's a great physical therapist. And Gerard said, Eamon, you know, it's going to take time and you're running against time. He said, I'm not going to cure your injury, but I can do an awful lot of flexible work on you, deep tissue and work. I can relieve the pain a little bit in the hamstring. So I came out that year, and I think I started off in like 4:03, which was really good. And I eventually ran 3:58.1. and became the first person to run a sub 4 minute mile at 40 years of age or older. I retired that day.
Yeah.
I went out on my terms. And it was just self-satisfying, really, to be able to go out on those terms rather than going out.
Where did you do the 358?
So that was done in Boston, in Harvard.
Right.
Yeah. Now, originally, I was hoping to do it in the USA Championships in Atlanta. The previous year, they were always in the Madison Square Garden. So when it came, and I missed it around the 401. So when it came to Atlanta, they said, "Nah, we don't want the old guys down here. Dwight Stones wanted to become the first guy to run, jump 7 feet in the high jump. You want to become the first 40-year-old to run. Nah, we don't. They don't know you in Atlanta. They know you in New York." So when you decided not to have the old guy run, I set up a meet at the Massachusetts State High School Championships in Harvard. And I brought my rabbit along. I brought all the other masters. I brought my own TV. I brought my own sponsors. I had to set all that up for myself. Because I believed I could do it. Anyhow, at halftime in the high school championships, the Masters Mile came about. Stanley Redwine was a great 800 meter runner back then. He was to take me through the first 800 or half mile in just under 2 minutes. I passed him out before the half mile mark because he was slowing down. Yeah, yeah. So I ran the last four laps of that race on my own. And I'll never forget, with one lap to go, the announcer is saying, "And Coughlin is on course for the record. Come on, let's hear Coughlin home." And I said to myself, "I've heard this before. Put the head down." And the noise of all these kids screaming and screaming and screaming was hurting my eardrums. Anyhow, I forgot about the pain and I went up the home straight, went over the finish line, and bang, I saw the time, 3:58. And one of my great mates, he was a photographer, still a photographer in World Athletics to this day, said to me before the race, "Coughlin, will you do me a favour?" I go, "What do you mean?" He said, "Would you ever smile when you're coming up the home straight?" I go, "What do you mean?"
"Well, you're not renowned for smiling, Emily."
No, he said, every picture I have of your face is contorted with pain. And would you believe, I thought of Victor literally up the home straight, and I went over the finish line. And when I did my little lap of honour, Victor says, "I got it. You got it. I got it. I got it." I said, "What do you mean you got it? I got the time." He says, "Yeah, but I got the picture. There's a smile on your face."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was great crack.
In about 1984, '85, it must have been, Kellogg's were doing giveaway at the time. So you collect, you know, you remember you used to cut off the barcodes off the back of the box, and you collect a certain number and you send off for, I can't remember, was there a range of posters that you'd have to select from?
Yeah.
But anyway, I have a vivid memory of, at two different occasions, the, you know, the thing that posters arrive in, you know, that
tube.
Circular tube.
Yeah.
And the first one, I think, was Stephen Roach, and then not long after that, Eamon Coughlin with the smile on his face. They were the first two posters that I had in my room at home. Euro 88 team followed, but they adorned my bedroom for many years. So that's the, you know, smiling, Eamon, was the point.
There's probably not a month goes by without me meeting somebody. "Hey, Eamon, lovely to meet you. I had a Caliper poster in my bedroom all my years." Yeah, like, yeah. Even yesterday I was in town here and a guy came to me running after me. "Hey, Eamon, you remember that Caliper poster? I still have that."
Yeah.
That's probably the one you're talking about.
What did you say? Was it Caliber?
Caliber. Caliber.
I definitely didn't have Caliber, but it was, I thought it was Kellogg's.
Yeah, it was the first non-alcoholic beer, and Guinness brought me back from America to do an ad to promote it, and created a poster when I won the World Championships. Yeah. And there was a very funny caption by one of the cartoonists in the Irish Times, I think it was, at the time. And I went by the Russian athlete, right? Clenched my fist, which was the poster, right? And the caption in the cartoon said, "What did Coughlin say to the Russian when he passed him? Drink Caliber. Smirnoff leaves you breathless." That was the old tagline for Smirnoff back then.
Can I ask you one last question about that? Because when you go over the line at Harvard and you've broken the record, what's the level of fulfillment that you got from that, given that you've been chasing it for a couple of years, versus passing the Russian in Helsinki or winning any of those Wanamaker miles? Because it feels like, you know, it's the end, so there's something even more emotionally invested in it.
Absolutely. It was fantastic from the point of view that I was devastated when I lost the Olympics in 76. I was really disappointed when I lost the Olympics. More disappointed when I pulled out in 84. And then obviously too old in 19. And I didn't like the way I went out because I wasn't satisfied. I believed I could win gold. I wasn't looking for a silver. I was just so confident, not cocky, but confident in my ability to be able to do that. So when I retired, I was pretty disappointed the way I went out. So thus, the sub-4 minute mile at 40 was my way of self-fulfillment. And when I did see that time, 3:58.17, it was total relief. I was absolutely delighted. I went out on my terms, despite those elite-level disappointments. And would you believe, as I mentioned earlier, Atlanta didn't want me to run in the mile down there. The Masters didn't want to put on a Masters mile. And the day after I broke the world record, the Masters mile record, a sub four, I got a call from Olin Castle, who was the president of USA, CEO of USA Track and Field. Hey, Eamon, congratulations. Will you come down to Atlanta? And I go, what do you mean? He said, NBC Television want Coughlin to run against Nurdin Mursali, Marcus O'Sullivan, and another in the race. And we'll give you a Mursali deal. And I go, what? You give me a Mursali deal? Nurdin Mursali was getting 50 grand a race.
Right, that's pretty good, yeah.
In 1994.
You could buy a house in Balls Bridge for that.
I turned it down.
Oh, right.
And I said, no, I'm going out on my terms.
Right.
I said, I want to take my master's degree from Harvard. Goodbye. And I retired that day.
That was it.
And I was delighted. And I was even encouraged to try and come and do it outdoors at the Penn Relays a few months later. And Greta Weitz, the great Norwegian champion, Laura Mercy on her, she passed away way too young. She was training in Gainesville with me and getting treated by Ger Hartman. And when I went back, say, 3 weeks after the indoor mile to prepare for the outdoor event, Greta, and I was still in pain, Greta turns to me and says, Eamon, why do you want to go and do it outdoors? You have become the first person to run the sub 4 minute mile. It doesn't matter if it was indoors or outdoors. She said, you are still in pain. You retire. You will get rid of the pain, you will get rid of the nerves, and you will get rid of the worry, and you can be refreshed for the rest of your life. And I said, Greta, you're right. Next day I was on a plane home, never
again. That was it. Yeah. That was it. All right. Well, Eamon, I enjoy these chats every year. The Griffith Avenue Mile, as I said, is on Sunday. I'm just going to get the exact date here for you.
Sunday the 21st, 3 p.m, and they can register at griffithavenuemile.ie. And that's it'll be a great family fun day. So no matter whether you're my age in the 70s, you can still bring your children and your grandchildren and you can run together with them and have a good day down there.
All right, Eamon, always great to have you in. Thanks
a
million.
Thank you.
Signed up for the Griffith Avenue Mile. Tomorrow we have a feature-length interview with Davy Russell from Altogether Now, which we haven't played out just yet, but that will be available tomorrow. Plenty more football and loads more to come as well. A reminder, we are with UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action. See you tomorrow, folks.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brian Mbeumo is a fantastic character as well as a fantastic footballer. And that's what Manchester United need. You know, you know what United have been missing. They've been missing leaders, responsibility takers.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.